Nobody does simultaneous exchanges, the priest said. Father, I've been involved in enough kidnappings in Colombia to know one thing. Anything is possible. But a simultaneous exchange is very dangerous. So many things can go wrong.
Are you sure about this, Alex? I asked.
If we give Joaquin half the ransom he expects, he'll either kill your father or continue to hold him until we cough up the other half. We have to tell him up front that 1.5 million is it, and the only way to make sure he doesn't double dip is to insist on a simultaneous exchange, unless you can think of a better idea.
I looked away, uneasy. Father, do you see another option? He just looked at me, his eyes filled with pity, as if there were no right answer. Then deliver the message, I told him, exactly as Alex said it. He grimaced, obviously uncomfortable.
I'd rather not have that responsibility. I fear the consequences.
You're our only connection to the kidnappers.
I don't like to negotiate with Joaquin. He's not like the organized guerrilla groups. He's too volatile.
That gave me pause. We were dealing with a guy who made narco-guerrillas seem stable. Father Balto seemed to sense my anxiety and said,
This is what I can do. Joaquin is supposed to call me at noon. Stay here, and you can deliver the message yourself.
Alex looked at me as if for approval. Let's do it, I said. There's no place I need to be.
I have a suggestion, said Father Balto.
What?
Mass is at 10. Why don't you join us?
Thank you, I replied. I will. Chapter 69. By the time the Mass was over, the rain had stopped. We waited outside in the picnic area for the noon telephone call. A South American priest with a cell phone struck me as somehow odd, but I sensed he had it for a very specific reason. Undoubtedly, this wasn't his first kidnapping. The cell phone was resting on the table between us, Alex and me on one side, Father Balto on the other. I watched without interest as a group of tourists snapped photographs on the observation platform behind the church. The priest seemed to have something on his mind. Alex asked,
What is it, Father?
His reluctance was evident, but curiosity won out.
$3 million is much money for a ransom. Even half that is much, much more than I've ever delivered before.
This is not your usual case, said Alex.
Your father must be very wealthy.
He's very blessed. I preferred to sidestep the whole insurance nightmare, though I had a sense that he'd know soon enough, if Joaquin would ever call. It was a few minutes past noon, and I was getting nervous. I checked to make sure the telephone was on. Father, are you sure Joaquin said noon?
He'll call. Don't worry.
And you're certain he said he'd phone you? He talks to us only by radio.
That's because a cell phone isn't an option when you're calling from the jungle.
So this means they're in the city now?
Definitely.
I asked Alex, do you think they ever were in the jungle? Or were they just using the radio to make us think that they were?
You never know. A straight criminal element like this, as opposed to one of the Marxist groups, is more often an urban operation, unless they have some kind of working arrangement with FARC or ELN.
So this is good, I said. They're back to where they feel most comfortable.
I suppose.
Her voice was flat, as if she sensed that I was reaching too far for anything positive. The phone rang, and I nearly jumped. The priest answered and gave me a nod, confirming that it was Joaquin. He spoke in such rapid Spanish that I didn't catch every word, but I detected considerable pleading in his tone. His hand was shaking as he handed the telephone to Alex.
God be with you, he said.
Alex held the phone just far enough away from her ear so that I could lean close and listen.
Good afternoon, she said amicably. Where's the money? He replied. In a very safe place. We have $1.5 million for you.
Congratulations! That's just enough to get him back dead.
That made my stomach flop, Alex said. Listen to me, Joaquin. This is a good faith offer.
I'm tired of this stalling. I don't know if it's you or the insurance company, but either way, I've had enough.
You have no idea what's going on with the insurance.
I know it's a $3 million policy. That's all I need to know.
It's blown up in everybody's face. Jaime's dead.
What?
He killed himself. It's over. The family was able to get you $1.5 million. It's all you're going to get.
That's not enough.
Don't be a pig. It's all yours, all $1.5 million. There's no kickbacks. No one you have to split it with. I'm serious. Jaime's dead.
There was silence on the line. Finally, he said,
If you're lying to me,
I'm not lying. Get on the internet. Check yesterday's Miami Herald.
Again, he paused. I was biting my lip, not sure that Alex had played the right card by dragging Jaime's death into this.
All right, he said. Give the money to the priest. If Jaime's really dead, I'll let the prisoner go.
No.
No?
He said, his voice rising with anger.
We're doing a simultaneous exchange.
Never!
Then you don't get your money.
Then I kill the prisoner.
Then I repeat, you don't get your money.
This was not the deal, damn you.
It's the deal now.
Then there's no deal.
Come on.
No. It's over. This guy has been trouble from the beginning. That was my 15-year-old cousin that got shot and killed by his Nicaraguan piece of trash crewman in Cartagena. I've had to watch him constantly, feed him, clothe him, put up with his disrespect. I couldn't get a fair price from FARC, couldn't get half a fair price from ELN, and now you want to shortchange me? Forget it. I'm done. We're done. He's done.
Wait, Alex said, but the line clicked.
I'd heard it all, my ear practically pressed against hers. I pulled away slowly, the sound of dead air from the telephone humming between us. Chapter 70. Matthew heard footsteps in the hallway, then shouting outside his closed door. He recognized the voices, the wild tempers. Evidently, drugs were as plentiful here as in the mountains. As the lock on the door rattled open, he braced himself for the worst.
Gringo!
Joaquin shouted. The light switched on, but the sudden brightness was an assault on his eyes. He felt snowblind to his surroundings as he sat up and shaded his eyes with chained hands. His vision was just beginning to return when, seemingly out of nowhere, a calloused hand slapped him across the head and knocked him to the floor.
Get up!
Matthew lay motionless. Joaquin grabbed him by the collar and threw him against the wall. Matthew was like a dog on a short leash, his body jerking in midair as the chains went taut. The fall had hurt his shoulder, and he heard himself groan. He heard laughter, too. And as his sight returned, he saw Cerdo and another guard standing in the doorway. It had been the same way in the mountains, when they'd thrown him in the hole. Punishment of the prisoners was the guerrilla's chief source of entertainment. Cerdo and his buddy were passing a bottle of rum between the two of them as Joaquin ran the show.
How much was your policy worth?
Shouted Joaquin.
What policy?
He kicked him in the groin. Matthew nearly blacked out, then struggled through it.
Don't lie to me. I know about Quality Insurance Company. How much was it?
Matthew could barely breathe, let alone answer. But if Joaquin knew the company name, there was no sense in playing totally dumb. A couple hundred thousand. Joaquin kicked him again, this time in the kidney. The pain shot in all directions. Another kick like that and Matthew feared it would kill him.
It's 3 million, said Joaquin. Whatever you say.
He grabbed Matthew by the hair, long, greasy locks that sorely needed shampoo.
It's not whatever I say. It's 3 million.
Matthew didn't answer. Joaquin seized his prisoner by the jaw, forcing him to look him in the eye.
I should kill you now, he said, snarling.
Matthew stared right back, more than matching the contempt of his captor. Joaquin shoved him down to the floor.
Unchain him.
On command, Cerdo rushed over with the keys. He was staggering, too much to drink. He rested the near-empty bottle of rum on the bed, then knelt down to unlock the cuffs. Matthew's mind raced, sorting through his limited options. This seemed to be the end of the line. After that speech from Cerdo the other day, he was certain that they were going to take him out to some alley, pump a dozen bullets into his face, and dump his body in the street. His fate seemed to be a pauper's grave, an unidentified corpse. He could go peaceably, or he could make good on the promise he'd made to himself when they'd left the mountains, when Cerdo had called out to Nisho, taunting the woman he and his buddies had gang-raped. Nisho, I love you. Nothing would have been better than to take out Cerdo and Joaquin, but this might be his only opportunity. he'd settle for just Cerdo. The moment the chains loosened, he shook free and grabbed the bottle of rum. In a blur, he slammed it against Cerdo's skull and burrowed the jagged glass into his neck, pushing down hard, twisting and turning the razor-sharp edges, gouging right at the carotid artery until his hands were covered in red. Cerdo squirmed and screamed in pain, blood gushing from his neck like a fountain. Joaquin slammed Matthew across the side of the head and knocked him to the floor. Cerdo rolled to one side, grabbing his throat, but the bleeding was unstoppable. The blood ran through his fingers and soaked his shirt. A huge crimson puddle covered the floor.
"The blood! Stop the blood!"
he cried in a panic. The other guard grabbed a dirty white bedsheet and shoved it against his neck. In seconds it had soaked through bright red. Cerdo got up on one knee, shook his fist weakly at Matthew, then fell to the floor. He lay motionless in his own blood. No one moved. Matthew stared at the lifeless body, then turned his gaze to Joaquin, certain that he was about to be executed. Joaquin stepped around the pool of blood to face Matthew directly. He drew his 9mm pistol from his holster and aimed at the prisoner's forehead. Matthew stared down the barrel of the gun, looking straight into the dark, narrow tunnel of death. It hardly seemed a fair trade, his life for trash as worthless as Cerdo. But it was the closest thing to justice that a prisoner could hope for. "Go ahead," he said defiantly. "Shoot me." The gun was shaking. Joaquin was so angry. His finger tensed on the trigger, but he didn't pull it.
"Lock him up,"
he shouted. Cerdo's buddy looked confused and horrified, but Joaquin shouted the order again.
"Lock him up."
This time the guard obeyed, and Matthew didn't resist. When the cuffs were in place, Joaquin came to him, put the gun to Matthew's temple, and said,
"I promise, I will shoot you. Right before your son's eyes."
Chapter 71. Alex brought dinner back to the apartment, but I didn't touch the food, as much as she'd assured me that the negotiations weren't really over, that Joaquin would cool down. It was hard not to take his outburst as final. My mind was already at my father's funeral, or perhaps memorial service was a more appropriate term, as I was certain that we'd never recover the body. We sat at opposite sides of the kitchen table, saying little. Another tearful bolero of lost love was playing on the evening program of Radio Recuerdo. The Holy Infant and Our Lady of Perpetual Help were watching us from framed pictures on the wall. Alex kept apologizing for eating in the face of my total loss of appetite, but I was caught up in my own thoughts. "Maybe you shouldn't have mentioned Jaime." It was out of the blue, a random comment that had jumped the track in my speeding train of thought. Alex looked up from her plate of pasta. "Are you going to dissect every word of that phone call?" "I just remembered catching my heart in my throat when you mentioned Jaime. For all we know, he was Joaquin's uncle or cousin or whatever. Telling him that Jaime was dead might have been the very thing that triggered his anger." "He was bound to find out sooner or later. Better that I presented it as a suicide rather than let him leap to the conclusion that you killed him the same way the police did." I went to the refrigerator for a bottled water. I was trying to stay focused on my father and deal with one problem at a time. Soon, however, I'd have to clear my own name back home. "Do you think I killed him?" She coughed and said,
"What?
You heard me. Do you think I killed Jaime?"
"Of course not."
"Why not? After all, the guy turned my father over to kidnappers."
"I didn't say you didn't have motive."
"Then how can you answer my question so quickly and say, 'Of course not'? Why wouldn't I kill him?" She was half smiling.
"Because you have much more self-restraint than I do."
"Thanks, I think." Her expression turned serious.
"You're not the only one who had motive, you know. Maggie Johans had motive, too. So did a lot of people at Quality Insurance, people who stood to lose plenty if Jaime started to name names. The police will realize that."
"I hope you're right."
"I know I'm right."
I saw no doubt in her eyes, only a reassuring blend of confidence and sincerity. "Thanks."
A knock on the door broke the silence. "Visitors?" I asked, confused. "Let me check." She rose quickly and went straight to her room.
In seconds, she was back with gun in hand. It was the first time I'd seen her react so defensively, a sure sign that I wasn't the only one feeling the tension. Standing to the side of the door, she asked in Spanish, "Who is it?"
"Father Balto."
It sounded like his voice, and he was the only person to whom Alex had given our address. She opened the door cautiously, leaving it chained.
"Are you alone?"
"Yes. May I come in, please?"
She peered into the hallway through the opening, then removed the chain and let him in. His black raincoat was wet with the early evening drizzle. Alex took it and left it on the hall tree with his umbrella. He greeted me kindly as we gathered at the kitchen counter.
"I have a message from Joaquin," he said.
I caught my breath. "Good or bad news?"
"Good, I believe. He will take the deal."
"Seriously?"
$1.5 million simultaneous exchange on one condition," he said, raising a finger to make his point. "The son delivers the ransom."
"No," said Alex.
"How can we say no?"
"I don't like it," she said.
"I would have expected him to make us wait, sweat a few days. That was too fast on the turnaround. Makes me nervous."
"That's Joaquin," said the priest. "I said it before, he's very volatile."
"Which means that we can't keep pushing his buttons," I said. "He's cut the ransom in half. He's giving us a simultaneous exchange. We have to give him something."
"That doesn't mean we should give him you," said Alex.
"He said this is his final offer," said the priest.
"Kidnappers always say that."
"Maybe this time he means it," I said. She hesitated. I could see in her eyes that she didn't want to go out on that limb, telling me that Joaquin didn't mean it, only to have my father's death on her own hands.
"If you go," she said, "I'm going with you."
"How about it, Father?" I asked. He shrugged, struggling.
"Technically, he didn't say you had to come alone. He just wants the son to deliver the ransom."
"Then it's settled."
Father Balto placed his cell phone on the counter.
"Joaquin asked that I give you this. From here on out, your instructions will be by cell phone."
Alex reached for it, but the priest stopped her.
"You can join in the delivery of the ransom, but I think he's expecting to speak directly with his son."
She stepped back warily.
"I don't like this, Nick."
"Nobody does, least of all my father." I took the phone and tucked it into my pocket. "But none of us has a choice." Father Balto and I shared his umbrella on the short walk down the street to the drugstore. I had no conception of the traceability of long-distance calls from Bogota to Miami, but I didn't want to learn the hard way. The last thing I needed was to lead the FBI's legal attachés to the apartment. I closed myself in a phone booth in the back of the drugstore and dialed Jenna. I wanted to tell her what had been happening, but she seemed more eager to tell me something.
"I found you a lawyer, a sharp former prosecutor named Jerry Houlihan.
I've heard good things about him.
I was hoping you'd approve. Your mom and I authorized him to start working right away. The police executed a search warrant on your Jeep today."
"They what?"
"They found your father's gun under the front seat."
I could have clubbed myself with the phone. Damn. I put it there when the police got to Jamie's house and ended up going straight to the airport from the police station. Couldn't very well take it on the plane with me.
"Nick?"
"What?"
"Why did you take a gun with you to Jaime's house?"
"Because he invited me there and I didn't know what to expect. Hell, the last time I went there he pulled a knife on me. You know all about that."
"I don't know as much as you think. You and Jerry have to talk soon. He keeps asking me questions that I can't answer."
"I'll try to call him tomorrow."
"Try hard, please. I don't mean to downplay the kidnapping, but this is serious. They could charge you with murder."
"Don't get discouraged, all right? And tell my mom not to worry either. We'll straighten the whole thing out when I get home. Could be soon."
"Is something about to happen with your father?"
"Definitely."
"You think it could finally be over?"
"One way or the other, yes, it could be over." She paused as if she didn't like the sound of that.
"Be careful, okay?"
"I will."
"This is really scaring me."
"Me too," I said, my voice fading. The call came at midnight. The distinctive chirping of a cell phone on the end table. I nearly jackknifed in response, launching my tired body from a comfortable slumber on the couch. Alex came running from the bedroom. I flipped open the receiver, swallowed the lump in my throat, and answered.
"Hola."
He didn't answer right away, but I recognized the voice as soon as he began.
We'll do this in English, but I'll only say it once, so listen good, understand?
Alex sat right beside me on the couch, her ear close enough to listen.
Yes, I answered. 5:30 tomorrow evening. Be at Cementerio Central.
The cemetery?
Don't interrupt. Go to the grave of Gonzalo Jimenez de Quesada. Bring the money and the cell phone. Wait in front of the monument. I'll call you. Don't be late.
Wait, what grave?
I told you I'd say it once.
The line clicked.
Damn it, what grave?
I clutched the phone tightly, shaking it in frustration.
Don't worry, I got it, said Alex.
You sure?
It's probably the largest monument in the cemetery. He's the founder of Bogota.
Why would Joaquin send us there?
A quiet, isolated spot in the middle of a city of 8 million people. If something goes wrong, he has hundreds of escape routes down surrounding side streets in every direction.
He could have sent us to the park.
He could have. But that wouldn't have set your mind to thinking the way a cemetery does, would it?
No, I said, trying to keep my mind from going there. Definitely not.
Chapter 72. We reached the cemetery right on schedule, just a few minutes before 5:30 p.m. Our arrival was timed perfectly. We didn't want to be standing around any longer than necessary with $1.5 million in a knapsack, even if we were both armed. Alex had insisted that I carry a gun, which made good sense to me. It had taken her only a small portion of that Monday to scrounge up an Austrian-made Glock 9mm pistol.
"This will stop a charging rhinoceros in its tracks," she'd said, placing the gun in my hand. "Use it only if you intend to kill someone."
Her warning had unleashed weeks of pent-up emotions that suddenly bubbled forth to form a conscious thought that chilled me. I'd never laid eyes on this Joaquin, but for all he'd done to my father, my mother, my family, I did indeed want him dead. Trading in human lives had to be the most despicable crime on earth. The afternoon was overcast, the sun completely hidden. Less than a half hour of daylight remained. Trees stood leafless against a sad, gray November sky. There was a slight chill in the damp air, no breeze to stir it. Bogota's notorious smog, the byproduct of more than 1 million vehicles, hovered over the graves like the stench of death itself. The cemetery grounds covered a vast rectangular expanse surrounded by a city that had grown around it. Many of the magnificent stone memorials were centuries old, discolored and decaying from the elements, the pollution, the vandals. Blaring horns and other rumblings of urban life could be heard in the distance, not loud enough to be disruptive, but enough to make me wonder if anyone here truly rested in peace. Alex and I followed the footpath to the impressive crypt of Gonzalo Jimenez de Quesada. She hadn't overstated the size of the plot. In the rear was a crypt as large as some churches. Before it was an impressive stone marker in a courtyard setting. The entrance was flanked by two short, decorative iron posts that were linked by a single strand of black chain. It sagged in the middle like a sad smile. A man emerged from behind the crypt. I started, then calmed, at the familiar sight of Father Balto.
"Joaquin asked me to come," he said. "I'm supposed to go with you from here."
"Go where?" The question had barely left my lips when the cell phone rang. "Hello," I answered.
"Walk 100 meters to the statue of the Blessed Virgin. Wait there, just you and Father Balto."
"We have Alex with us."
"Not Alex. If I see anyone but you and the priest at that statue, your father gets a bullet. Got it?"
He hung up, leaving no room for debate. I switched off the phone and repeated his orders, verbatim, to Alex.
"You can't go without me," she said.
"He said he'd kill my father if you come."
"If I don't come, he'll kill your dad and take you in his place."
"How do you know that?"
"He's a kidnapper and a murderer. Your only hope is if I'm there."
"I'd agree with you if he'd told me to come alone, but I have Father Balto with me. There has to be a show of good faith."
"Are you crazy? These people would shoot you in front of God himself. They kidnap people from churches."
"Can I say something?"
the priest said. "Sure,
I've dealt with Joaquin before. My only wish is to help you get your father back safely. But I'm not going anywhere if we don't follow Joaquin's instructions to the letter.
Alex was about to say something when a sudden noise silenced us, a cry from somewhere beyond the statue. I listened more closely. It came again, this time more clearly.
Nick!
It was my father. Just the sound of his voice had my adrenaline pumping. I looked at Alex and said, "Cover us, but stay out of sight." I checked my gun, slung the money over my shoulder, and started toward the statue of the Blessed Virgin, just me and Father Balto.
The gag was back in his mouth, fastened tightly behind his head. A fresh cigarette burn smoldered just below his eye in the soft, sensitive skin near the tear duct.
Matthew had refused to play a voluntary role in Joaquin's scheme. He'd yielded to the command and shouted his son's name only after the pain had become unbearable. Joaquin peered out over the top of a huge granite marker. Matthew was even better concealed, kneeling in a half-dug grave behind a pile of fresh dirt. Joaquin's partner, the one who'd watched Cerdo bleed to death, kept the prisoner in check at gunpoint. Only now did Matthew finally recognize him as one of the executioners who, along with Joaquin, had taken Will the Canadian for his last walk into the jungle. The sound of approaching footsteps made Matthew cringe. He knew that his son was coming. Worse, he knew it was an ambush.
Joaquin cocked his pistol and smiled. Way to go, fisherman. You reeled him in nicely.
Chapter 73.
That's far enough.
I stopped just a few paces away from the statue of the Blessed Virgin. I recognized the voice as Joaquin's, yet I resisted the impulse to turn and look behind me, fearing the consequences of any sudden movements.
Look straight ahead. Put the money on the ground. And put your hands over your head. Move very slowly.
I did exactly as told, moving almost in slow motion. I slipped the knapsack off my shoulder and lowered it to the ground, then raised my hands.
Count it, Padre.
Father Balto knelt on the grass and opened the knapsack. His hands shook as he fumbled through the stacks of $100 bills. I watched for a few seconds, then better used the time to get a lay of the land, though my line of sight was shrinking in the waning daylight. With each passing moment, another distant row of stone crosses and headstones slipped into the dark onset of night.
It all appears to be here, the priest shouted.
Joaquin said,
take the bag and step over to the statue.
He took it, then retreated in silence to the statue of the Blessed Virgin.
Turn around, Yankee.
I assumed that was me. I turned my head slowly, then my whole body. I visualized myself reaching for my gun, trying to discern how quickly I could get to it if needed. Not quickly enough, I feared. The gray skies were nearly black. All around the perimeter of the darkening cemetery, city lights began to twinkle, marking the end of another day. Deep within this vast urban graveyard, it was as if we were falling into a black hole. Distant lights were visible, but my immediate surroundings were fading into the shadows. Slowly, my eyes began to adjust, and I could almost make out the pained expression on the familiar face that was staring back at me from 20 meters away. The body was slimmer than I'd remembered, but the countenance was the same. The man with the gun to his head was definitely my father. My eyes locked on his battered image. Weeks of captivity seemed to have taken a greater toll than a lifetime at sea. My gaze shifted toward Joaquin.
You have your money. Now let him go. Is that what you expect?
That was the deal.
We have a deal, you say? Is that how you think this works? You change it every which way you please, and then finally you announce that we have a deal?
We were negotiating.
There wasn't supposed to be any negotiating. That was the deal.
Your deal with who, Jaime? He just scoffed and said,
this was supposed to be an easy one. What a joke.
It can still be easy. There's a sack full of money right over there. Take it and give me my father. He let out a mirthless chuckle.
Just let him go, eh?
That's what we agreed.
Sure. I'll let him go if you come with me.
It was as if he'd punched me in the chest. That's not what we talked about.
I don't care what we talked about. You're getting the money, no more. What's the matter? Don't you love your father? Hasn't he suffered enough? Be a good son. Come with me. Set your old man free.
Father Balto stirred.
Joaquin, please, shut up. I'm talking to the Yankee.
I was out of things to say. I couldn't possibly go with him, but I didn't want to set him off.
Time's up, said Joaquin.
Stop playing games. He shoved the pistol against my father's skull.
You're right. Forget the swap. Why don't I just kill your old man and take you at gunpoint?
I was a split second away from reaching for my gun.
Wait! Alex shouted, gun drawn. She'd given up her hiding spot and was standing in the open. Not exactly what I'd had in mind when I'd asked her to cover us.
I braced myself for a three-way gunfight, but Joaquin showed restraint. He tightened his grip on my father and said,
Get out of here, Alex!
She aimed her gun in his direction, but he was using my father as a human shield.
Give me the prisoner, she said.
Go to hell!
Give him to me, and I'll give you the other 1.5 million.
My heart was racing. I couldn't possibly stop her, but this seemed like a dangerous bluff. Inch by inch, she was moving closer to Joaquin, talking to him all the way.
Jaime didn't kill himself.
My God, is she going to point the finger at me?
So he's not dead? Said Joaquin.
Oh, he's dead, all right. He was about to name names. I couldn't let him do that.
I nearly buckled at the knees.
Is she still bluffing? You scammed me, said Joaquin.
No, you scammed me. Killing the prisoner wasn't part of the deal. Now hand him over if you want the whole 3 million.
I could hardly speak, but I forced out the words.
Alex, what the heck is going on?
She didn't answer. Joaquin said,
What's the matter, Yankee? Did she fool you into thinking that Jaime acted alone? Did you really believe that a little insurance dweeb in Miami has gorilla friends?
I looked at Alex, the former FARC girl.
My God, you know him. That's why he agreed to a simultaneous exchange. He knew we wouldn't call the police because someone on the other side was on his side.
Quiet, Nick.
Joaquin jerked my dad forward.
Everyone shut up. I'm in control here.
That's right, said Alex, speaking more like the calm negotiator. And you can still be the big winner, all 3 million. No one to split it with.
My eyes darted back and forth, from Alex to my father to Joaquin. She may have scammed us at the beginning, but when it came to the money, I knew that she was bluffing Joaquin. Was she trying to make amends?
Whose side are you on, Alex?
Stay out of this, she answered.
I'd like to know that too, Joaquin snapped. Whose side are you on?
Do you want the money or don't you?
Does this mean you're not taking your cut? He asked.
I said you could have it all.
But I want to hear you say it to your client. Tell the Yankee that you're not taking your cut.
I was never getting a cut.
What do you call 50%?
Every penny of it was Jaime's.
She was staring at Joaquin as she spoke, aiming her gun right at him, but I sensed that she was talking for my benefit.
All I wanted was for you and your thugs to leave my family alone.
She raised her voice, as if to make sure I heard.
That's all I ever wanted, Nick, just to buy a little peace for what's left of my family in Bogota.
Such a sad story, Joaquin said with sarcasm.
She adjusted her aim.
Someone should have killed you a long time ago.
A long time ago, I should have let you bleed to death on the side of the road with a knife in your back.
You don't own me just because you pulled me out of a ditch, and you can't make me come back to you by threatening my family.
But I could make you scam the Yankee.
Even in the dim light, I could see the anger on her face. One look at my father confirmed that we were sharing the exact same fear. Alex was about to squeeze off a shot at Joaquin, but anything less than perfection would kill the hostage, the human shield.
Alex, I shouted, reaching for my gun. In the same instant, my father broke free from Joaquin's grasp. A shot rang out as he rolled to the ground, but it missed and shattered a clay pot. I dived to the ground and fired repeatedly at Joaquin. Alex was shooting too, as she and Father Balto ran for cover behind the big statue. Joaquin fired back, as did someone else, from behind a dirt pile, and the barrage of bullets erupted as if it were a war zone.
My father was out of sight, having slid behind a gravestone. Joaquin fired a few more shots in his direction, but Alex and I pinned him down with gunfire. I crouched low behind my marker, bullets whizzing over my head. Suddenly, all was quiet in the darkness. I sat, crouched behind the headstone, breathless from the exchange of gunfire, my back against cold granite. Darkness had completely overtaken us, no moon or stars in the night's overcast sky, just a dim glow from distant city lights. I listened carefully for any movement about me, but I heard only the sounds of my own erratic breathing. "Brothers, please!" shouted a brave Father Balto, but three quick gunshots sent him scampering back into hiding. That son of a bitch just tried to kill the priest. My hand shook as I dug the cell phone from my pocket. I dialed the police and tried to speak to a dispatcher in Spanish, but the wireless reception was terrible, and my scattered thoughts produced only fragmented sentences, partly in English. "Las pistolas, los kidnappers en el cementerio central. Ven acá, por favor." Bullets sailed over my head. In my panic, I was making no sense, and my talking was giving away my position to the enemy. The dispatcher hung up on me, and I held little hope that Colombian police would actually come charging into the cemetery at night to stop an ill-described gunfight. I crouched low to reload my weapon. My first shootout, and it was going to be the death of one of us. But who would fall? And who was on which side? In my mind, I quickly replayed the last exchange of gunfire. Alex had fired at Joaquin. That meant she was in my camp, despite anything she'd said. But someone else with Joaquin had been firing what sounded like an automatic weapon. That made it two against two at best. Father Balto was unarmed, but he was with Alex. The only unprotected player was my father. A sick feeling came over me as I knew what I had to do. Somewhere in the darkness among all those gravestones, my father was hiding, praying for his life. I had to find him before Joaquin did. Chapter 74. Matthew thanked the Lord for darkness. In the confusion of gunfire, slithering across the grass like a snake on his belly, he'd found his way to an overcrowded collection of tall markers that stood one beside the other, almost on top of one another, a veritable forest of towering stone crosses and statues of patron saints. His hands were cuffed behind his back, his ankles tied, and his mouth gagged. It was a bit of ironic luck that Joaquin had removed the blindfold to torture his eye. The left one had blistered and swollen shut from the cigarette burn, but the right one gave him the precious advantage of sight. He lay perfectly still, almost afraid to breathe. The slightest movement could reveal his whereabouts, which would be deadly. He knew that Joaquin had brought him here to avenge the death of Cerdo, to execute the prisoner right before his son's eyes. Matthew was ready for that. For weeks he'd been preparing himself for the possibility of his own death. One thing, however, he hadn't prepared for, the death of his son in a botched rescue effort. He burrowed into hiding at the base of a huge stone marker, pleading with his maker to take him and not Nick. Nothing moved. Not anywhere. I was peering out over the top of my marker, some dead stranger's resting place. Somewhere across the grounds, hiding behind one of those countless slabs of stone, were Joaquin and his well-armed buddy. I'd been waiting for one of them to break toward my father, or at least in the direction I'd last seen my father go. Maybe they were being patient. Or maybe they'd already made their move and I'd missed them. I couldn't risk it. I had to take the offensive. But to where? Had I been my father, I would have crawled toward the cluster of old monuments beneath the two sprawling oak trees. Compared to the rest of the cemetery, it was like midtown Manhattan, towering granite everywhere, lots of little places to get lost. On hands and knees, keeping low to the ground, I headed in that direction, one monument at a time. Matthew's heart nearly stopped. He hadn't budged from his hiding spot, hadn't made a sound. Lying in the darkness with hands and feet bound, he felt invisible and vulnerable at the same time. He knew it was only a matter of moments before Joaquin would spot him. He knew, because he could see Joaquin. Joaquin was kneeling behind the dirt pile, the lower half of his body hidden in the half-dug grave. His pistol at the ready, he raised his head just high enough to see over the tops of the gravestones, searching for the enemy.
It would have been an easy shot for Matthew, a steady target at just 15 meters. The kill shot would have been to the side of Joaquin's head, as Matthew was perpendicular to him on the same row of graves. If only his hands were free. If only he'd had a gun, a knife, anything. So many times he'd thought of giving Joaquin exactly what he deserved for the murder of his friends on the boat in Cartagena, for the gang rape of Nisho up in the mountains, for countless other atrocities that he and his buddies had bragged about. Matthew had no regrets for having killed Cerdo. It sickened him to think that Joaquin might walk free, a wealthy man. Joaquin looked in his direction, looked away, and then did a double take. Their eyes met in the darkness. Matthew had been spotted. Neither man blinked, neither looked away. Matthew refused to cower to his executioner. Joaquin smiled slightly, then raised his pistol and aimed between the eyes. I was just a few meters from the forest of monuments when I heard Alex shout from somewhere in the darkness, "Joaquin, take it!" The knapsack sailed through the air and landed with a thud. A volley of gunshots erupted, both Joaquin and his accomplice reacting with pointless fire at the sackful of money. It was exactly what Alex had intended, I presumed, and she'd startled Joaquin into revealing his position. Alex and I fired repeatedly in the direction of the half-dug grave, me from my position at the Forest of Monuments, and Alex from farther away, near the statue of the Blessed Virgin. Return fire ripped through the night, mostly in my direction, as I was the closer threat, just a few meters away from them. I scampered into the maze of taller monuments for better cover, a trail of bullets rattling off the stones with the beat of a jackhammer. I rolled several times to avoid the spray of gunfire, collided with a large stone pedestal, then froze at the sight of the body two graves away. Dad. I crawled as fast as I could to his side. He was face down in the dirt, but raised his head at my touch. "It's me," I said in an excited whisper. I yanked the gag from his mouth. "Are you hit?" "No, no. They're so coked up they shoot worse than you do." I hoped that someday we'd laugh at that. "Thanks a lot. Untie me." I unknotted the ropes at his feet, but his hands were in cuffs, which would have to wait. "There's two of them," he said. "Who's with you?" "Just the priest and Alex." "Who's this Alex?" I thought for a second about all the things she'd just said. "Damned if I know." We ducked at the explosion of gunfire, but it wasn't coming our way. They were shooting in the opposite direction, at Alex. "She must be making a move," I said. "If I attack from this flank, we might take them. Stay here." He nearly tripped me in his zeal to keep me down. "What do you think you're doing?" I looked him in the eye, hoping that he wouldn't take it the wrong way, but it was something that I'd wanted to say for 15 years, since that day on the fishing boat that had driven us apart. "Acting like my father's son," I said. "You don't have to do this. If I don't, neither one of us is getting out alive." He didn't argue, and there wasn't time for it anyway. Another burst of gunfire erupted on the far side. I glanced up and saw Alex running from the statue of the Blessed Virgin to another monument. She was definitely on the offensive, and she was definitely outgunned. "This is it," I said, then sprinted forward, zigzagging from monument to monument. I moved in short bursts to avoid getting hit, but I didn't fire a shot as the exchange was all in Alex's direction. The noise was deafening, one shot after another without interruption. Alex had come on so strong that both kidnappers had turned their weapons on her. I was just 10 meters away, approaching from the side, when Joaquin's sidekick took a bullet from Alex to the forehead. His head snapped back as he tumbled to the ground, his gun silenced. Joaquin kept firing his pistol, stopping only briefly to reach for his slain friend's AK-47. "Freeze!" I shouted. I had him from behind. "Manos arriba!" shouted Alex. She had him from the side. He raised his arms, still on his knees behind the pile of earth from the half-dug grave. "Stand up!" I shouted. He rose as commanded. The pistol was still in his hand. "Turn around slowly and drop the gun!" He turned to face me, but kept his weapon. "Drop the gun!" It was pointed in the air, but he wouldn't let go. "Drop it right now or I'll shoot!" "How many men have you killed before, Yankee?" He was clearly mocking me, reminding me that the dead gorilla at his feet was Alex's work, not mine. "You'd be a good start," I said. His hand moved in a blur as he fired off what seemed to be a wild shot. I squeezed the trigger again and again, firing off as many shots as possible. His body jerked with each hit as he fell, landing in a heap in the open grave.
I took a half step forward, close enough to confirm that he looked very dead. The body was twisted, the limbs angled in every direction like a mangled spider. I'd hit him at least 3 times, twice in the chest and once in the face. I moved closer and checked for a pulse. "He's gone," I said, loud enough for my father to hear. I turned away from the grisly sight. As I rose, out of the corner of my eye, I saw Alex stagger and fall to the ground. "Alex!" She didn't answer. I ran to her, weaving between monuments, jumping over the last one to find her lying on her side between 2 gravestones. She was shivering as I rolled her onto her back. Blood had soaked through her sweater at the ribcage just below the heart. Joaquin's last shot had hit its mark. "My God, you need an ambulance."
"Don't bother. Nobody survives this. I got what I deserved."
I just shook my head. "So it's true. You killed Jaime."
"I never thought it would get this crazy."
"Damn you, I trusted you. I believed in you." A trickle of blood oozed from the corner of her mouth, her voice barely a whisper.
"Funny. I thought they'd hold some rich guy for a week or two, get the insurance money and let him go. That was the deal. Get Joaquin a nice chunk of money, and he'd leave me and my family alone forever."
"I can't believe you'd do that."
"Live in fear for 15 years. You'd be surprised at what you'll do."
"I'd never sell out another human being."
She grimaced from the pain and took my hand.
I pulled back, but she squeezed harder and wouldn't let me go.
"Please, don't hate me."
I was trembling, still shocked. "I just wish this weren't true."
"Then let's just leave it that I was a friend."
She looked at me and tried to smile, the life draining from those dark, mysterious eyes. She started to say something more, but it passed. Her body went limp in my arms. I held her for a moment, my emotions running the gamut. I lowered her head to the ground, then looked up and saw my father standing over us.
"Was she a friend of yours?"
he asked sadly. The question made me think back to the anonymous note that had led me to Jaime's door, the way it had been signed, and the way Alex had just used the same words to say goodbye.
"In a weird way, yes. I guess she was a friend."
I rose and embraced my father so tightly that our bodies shook. He was sobbing cathartically into my shoulder as I opened my eyes for one last look at Alex, her beautiful face, the sad expression, the troubled life. If she hadn't told me herself, I would never have believed a word of it. From her lips, it all made perfect, horrible sense.
"Let's go home," my father whispered.
"Yes," I said with a lump in my throat.
"Let's."
Epilogue. There were no empty seats at our Thanksgiving dinner table. Lindsay, my sister, was home for the first time in 2 years. Grandma was with us, doing as well as could be expected. My mother was smiling again, finally exuding the fabled glow that kicked in around the 5th month of pregnancy. In less than 2 weeks, Dad was already looking better and slowly gaining some needed weight. The mountain of mashed potatoes and dressing on his plate would surely help the cause.
"Do we have any sushi?" asked Lindsay. "It's Thanksgiving, dear," my mother said reprovingly.
She rolled her eyes and put a sliver of turkey on her plate. I just smiled to myself. For all the family had been through, thankfully we hadn't changed completely. Naturally, some things would never be the same. My days at Cool Cash were over. That was just as well, since the Miami office surely wouldn't survive the firestorm anyway. Before his murder, Jaime Ochoa had given a sealed letter to his mother with instructions to hand it over to the state's attorney if anything untoward should happen to him. It spelled out the entire scheme. Maggie Johans was named prominently in the cover-up, and she'd spent the last 2 weeks trying to save her own criminal skin by insisting that she'd acted on the advice of Duncan Fitz. From what I'd read in the newspapers, it wouldn't be long before they both came crashing down, taking a huge chunk of the firm's pristine reputation with them. The saddest part of Jaime's letter was what he'd written about Alex, detailing the way she'd linked his stolen information about the insurance policy to the kidnappers who capitalized on it. I imagined she'd regretted it from the beginning, which was why she'd stayed on to help negotiate Joaquin down even after the insurance company had fired her and denied my father's claim. A bigger part of me, however, felt only anger, betrayal, and increasing confusion over that speech she'd delivered before dying. I wondered if she'd really believed that serving up an American would buy her own family a lifetime of safety from Joaquin and his band of killers. Or had she made the whole thing up, one last deception? The more I thought about it, the more it seemed that even if her motive hadn't been greed, perhaps she and Jaime both had gotten what they deserved. My sense that justice had been done only intensified when I learned that a certain Japanese couple, Nisho and her husband, were also K&R policyholders with Quality Insurance Company. Fortunately, the scam was uncovered before any other names were sold to kidnappers. From what my father had told me, I was certain that when Nisha was finally released, it would take a lot more than $1.5 million to settle her claims against Quality Insurance. As for my own legal woes, Jaime's letter was a godsend. His own written words had taken me off the list of murder suspects, as did the forensic evidence. Before its throat was slit, Jaime's dog had clawed the skin of the real murderer, and the DNA test of the scrapings from under the nails didn't match me. They matched Alex. That, plus the sworn affidavit of the Colombian priest who had overheard Alex's confession, pretty much guaranteed that my next role would be not as a defendant in a murder trial, but as a grand jury witness in the imminent criminal prosecution against Quality Insurance Company and the lawyers who'd orchestrated the cover-up. It was one more thing to be thankful for on this holiday. "Everything's delicious, honey," my father said. "Best ever," I added. My father smiled at me as he reached for another slice of my mother's famous cornbread. "Nick, I was thinking about taking the Bertram out tomorrow. Sailfish are running. It's catch and release, pure sport." "Who's going?"
"Just me so far. I was hoping you might want to come along."
It might have been a small thing in other families, but with our past, this was huge.
"I'd like that a lot."
"Good. Set your alarm for 4:15. I coughed on my ice water. Lindsay snickered and said, "Be careful what you wish for." The phone rang and my mother dropped the gravy ladle. The kidnapping was over, but some of the reflexes remained. The ringing continued 2-3 times. With my mother's reaction, no one moved. It was strangely cathartic, allowing the phone to beckon until it stopped, no compelling need to answer it. Dad broke the silence.
"This seems like a good opportunity to settle some family business. Your mother and I have been talking about what to do with the money."
He meant the $1.5 million, of course. Though technically it was supposed to have been used for payment of his ransom, it was ours now, the proceeds of my lump sum settlement with Quality Insurance. My father could do with it as he wished. "After Nick gets back his out-of-pocket losses, I want to buy out Guillermo and take over the business myself. The way the company's been losing money, it shouldn't take much. I'm sure I can turn it around with him out of my hair." I nodded. Even though the drug allegations appeared to have been manufactured by Guillermo's ex-wife, Dad was still better off without him.
"You'd do well to distance yourself from him anyway," I said. "I want Grandma to get the best care available. And of course we'd like to set something aside for our 3 children, the 2 of you and your future little brother or sister," he added, smiling as he laid his hand on my mother's belly.
"Sounds good to me," said Lindsay.
His expression turned more serious. "Beyond that, there are a couple people outside the family I want to take care of. Hector's widow, for one. She lost a husband and a son in that shootout in Cartagena."
"That's the right thing to do," I said.
"And there's Jenna. She put a lot of time into this for no pay."
"She definitely came through when no one else would," I said.
"I thought $50,000 would be fair."
I totally agreed with him, but I was slightly uncomfortable with the concept, or at least the timing.
You think it'll look like I'm trying to buy her back?
It might, said Lindsay, especially now.
What do you mean?
She seemed reluctant to speak up, not quite looking me in the eye. I wasn't going to say anything on the holiday, but my jogging route took me past Jenna's place this morning. There's a sold sign out on the front lawn.
It hit me hard, though I tried not to show it, hoping to keep our Thanksgiving upbeat. The way I felt about Jenna, however, was no secret in our house. Lindsay lowered her eyes, as did my mother.
I'm sorry, Nick, my father said.
Me too, I said, as I poked at my cranberry sauce. I went to see Jenna that night. Sure enough, dangling from the real estate agency's sign in her front yard was another little sign that said, Sold. Jenna had lain low since my father's return, insisting that it was best for the family to heal on its own for a while. I'd felt as if there were things left unsaid. Seeing the sold sign with my own eyes had only reinforced the feeling. I walked up the old Chicago brick walkway and knocked on the front door. Her car was in the driveway, so I knew she was home. The door opened, and she smiled faintly.
Hi.
I suddenly didn't know what to say. Wasn't sure you'd be in town.
This year the family was doing Thanksgiving with my brother and his kids in Seattle. I made an excuse. Just didn't feel like flying across the country.
Can I come in?
Sure.
I stepped inside, closed the door behind me, and followed her into the living room. It seemed strange the way our relationship had changed, yet everything in this room had remained exactly the way I remembered it. Even the big, cushy reading chair was in the same place, covering that ugly brown paint stain on the old Persian rug we'd purchased at an antique store for next to nothing. The chair was a recliner, but it had been out of commission ever since that night I was studying for the bar exam, when Jenna had climbed in with me, tossed my outlines aside, and nearly set the thing on fire, figuratively speaking.
"Have a seat," she said.
I started toward the memory chair, then thought better of it and took a seat on the couch.
"Want a soda? Beer?"
"No, thanks. I just wanted to talk." She took a seat on the ottoman on the other side of the cocktail table.
"How's your job hunting coming?"
"I've narrowed it down to two medium-sized firms in the Gables, both good groups of people. And they all seem to have a life outside the law firm. Imagine that, huh?"
"That would be a good move for you."
I nodded. I saw the sold sign out front. She blinked and said,
"Oh, that."
"Yeah, that."
"The deal's not even inked yet, and my agent put that out. She's fed up with me. Said that if I kill the deal this time, she's quitting."
"Kill the deal?"
"This is actually the third full-price offer I've received this month. I've managed to wiggle out each time."
"Sounds like you're not really sure about this move," I said, hopeful. She looked away, then back.
"I'm all over the map, literally. When I think about the low times, I feel like packing. Then I'll find something while I'm going through my stuff. A piece of jewelry or one of those mushy cards you used to write me in your own words. I'm totally confused."
My throat tightened. I had plenty to tell her, but I didn't want to say the wrong thing. "I don't want you to go."
"Is that what you came here to tell me?"
"That, and a lot of things."
"Like what?"
I didn't prepare a speech. I was kind of hoping you'd get all Jerry Maguire on me and tell me I had you at hello. That got a smile, then a little laughter. We'd seen the movie a few years earlier on one of our first dates, and she'd clearly remembered it as well as I had.
"Every now and then you get me right in the funny bone, you know that?"
Her smile faded and our eyes met.
"What are you thinking?"
she asked. "That I always want to make you laugh. That I wish you'd give us a second chance. That if you insist on trying to sell this place, I'm going to put a full-page ad in the paper saying it's haunted."
"Funny, that's exactly what I told the last buyer to get myself out of the deal."
"What do you say we go out and talk about this over a couple of drinks?"
"What do you have in mind?"
"Anything but a dark and stormy."
"Mojitos?"
Now you're talking.
She grabbed her sweater, and we started for the door. I know a new place over on South Beach. Best mojito you ever had, she said.
Really?
I guarantee it. She locked the front door, and we walked toward my Jeep.
That wouldn't be a lifetime guarantee, would it? I asked.
She climbed into her seat, shooting me a playful look.
One step at a time, Bozo.
Sure, I said, as I turned the ignition. Sounds good to me. Really good.
The End. You've been listening to A King's Ransom by James Grappando, narrated by George Guidel. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Under Cover of Darkness, also by James Grappando, narrated by Richard Poe, and A Walk in the Darkness by John Land, narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.